Yeah, my summer's gonna be a total blur. Like, someone come plan this wedding and get me skinny and tan and let me sit by the pool.
That's I think you I could need. Plan a wedding poolside.
I honestly think I could, yeah, but I gotta not get tan lines. That's complicated. You know, it's hard being me.
Okay, that's true. All right. Welcome to another episode of True Crime Creepers, where we talk about all the real life creeps, from serial killers to con artists. I'm Kristen, the true crime fanatic who loves to tell these stories.
And I'm Mogap, the true crime newbie who hasn't heard any of them. And we are a year older. Happy birthday to you.
The people loved celebrating your birthday. Yes. I just got back late last night from New York. So I spent...
You got back last night?
Sunday night. Yep.
Dang.
And then the flight wasn't even delayed. It was a flight attendant that was delayed. So we had to wait like an hour for this flight attendant. So I didn't end up getting home until like 10:30. So my suitcase is still on the couch.
That is so rude of her. Do you think she left her laptop at home and she had to go back?
Oh, yeah. Then I went to work this morning, left my laptop at home, had to come back during my break and pick it up. It's been a day, and now we're here. So
here we are. I had a fun appointment today doing wedding stuff.
What'd you do?
I went and did like a hair consultation for extensions.
No, wait, what?
Because my hair just like won't grow, so that's cool. Welcome to being an old bride.
But it wasn't like a trial. You didn't like put them on.
No, I didn't do that. She just kind of like looked for like color matching and like kind of, I've never had like real like professional extensions before. So she talked to me about that. But like, you know how I feel about hair. So like, I was really having a moment in there. I was like, listen, I don't own a hairbrush. I can't look at hair on the floor. I'll throw up. So whatever you need to do to make this look good, and I don't want to have to deal with it.
So what do you do when you're like at a salon?
I have coping techniques. I look straight forward, cannot look down at the ground, and I have a very thorough conversation with my stylist before. I mean, obviously you get to know these people really well. I'm like, don't let that stuff just lay on me like when they cut it and it's just like all over you. Blech, can't do it.
That is so interesting.
So there's that, all my business out there. I know, I had to tell this. This was the first time I met with her and I was like, yeah, I don't really like own a hairbrush. And
like
then,
you don't brush your hair at all?
Well, I have like a fat tooth like comb.
Oh, okay. So that's did she think that actually, was like, had she had clients before that had that kind of?
No, she thinks I'm a total weirdo. Are you kidding? I mean, I am.
Bummer.
But
I was hoping that really like nice. Maybe in that field she would have come across like tons of people with this affliction. But apparently
she
not.
Did tell me she can't deal with wet hair. And I thought that was interesting. I'm like, but you shampoo my hair. She's like, yeah, I know. I hate it. So it was funny. And Russell's a keeper because he bought me my first hairbrush and he will wait till I have left the premises and he'll empty it for me.
Oh, my God.
So that there's never that like hair in it. I know.
Oh, my God.
I'm so crazy. Speaking of my crazy, to the person that called out on the Instagram, they were like, how is Butterfly Effect one of the five movies that Mogap has seen? And when I said that, when you asked me about it on the episode, I was like, yeah, I've seen that. I literally thought to myself, how has that made the list of the movies I've seen? I haven't seen Clueless, but I've seen Butterfly Effect. So for the person that commented that, I also thought the same thing about my own self.
I also had several people that emailed me the thing that you texted me about how there's that company that's going to pay you $1,000 to watch all the Fast and the Furious movies.
Are you signing up to do it?
I'm going to apply. I got to do that for free. I got to catch up before the next movie comes out. So
I know. How long have we been talking about teasing that we're going to like recap the movies as mini creeps? And we honestly need to, but that was like our first mini creep. The beginning of time. We're like, we're going to watch all these. Maybe this summer. Maybe we'll get to it.
Yeah, that's what I always say. Maybe this summer when I have time and the summer just ends. It just like goes away. It's crazy. Well, should we talk about Patreon?
No.
Okay. Well, we're talking about the kidnapping. Okay, okay, okay. All right. So listen.
Don't do it. I like it.
Listen, I have a warning for you. We have a Patreon. Go check it out if you want it. I have a warning for you. Because we usually don't do cases that involve the murder of children. That's just a topic that I basically avoid.
Boo.
But this one does. And I know I really don't put trigger warnings on these. It's a true crime podcast. Listen at your own discretion. But on this one, I know that, like, anyways, that's a warning. If that's
all you gotta say. That sounds
with
terrible.
Own discretion. We are talking about the kidnapping and murder of Adam Walsh and the aftermath that changed everything.
Is there a reason why we're talking about this one if we don't normally?
Yes. And it will become clear at the end. It led to a lot of good things that happened. A lot of good changes. So that's why I wanted to talk about this one. And you'll kind of see what it is. You're not gonna make the connection for a while, but most people listening will. They'll already know who I'm talking about. They already know who I'm talking about. Speed it up. So
fine.
Big thanks to my girl Sabrina Eads, who helped research and write this.
Girl.
Yes. Huge help, especially with my trip to New York. I'm running out of time. Running out of time to do anything.
Oh my God, we get it. You're cultured.
All right. You ready?
Yeah.
Okay. It was July 27th, 1981 in Hollywood, Florida. Did you know there was a Hollywood, Florida?
No, but I feel like there's everything. Like Paris, Texas, you know?
Yeah. Hollywood, it's Florida. Near Miami. And Reve Walsh got a phone call. I'm not positive I'm saying Reve correctly, but that's what we're going to go with. She's got an accent mark on the E, so R-E-V-E with a...
Well, you already got your Americana out of me, Vanilla Vanilla, so
there you
say however you want.
Usually right. Yes. Also, we got an email from a listener in South Africa who said my pronunciation on the Miche Solomon case was very good. So I was happy to hear
Congratulations.
That.
Congratulations. You've come so
Thank
far.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Do you think I'm stalling starting this case? A little bit. A little bit.
I am.
So Reve Walsh gets this phone call on July 27th, 1981. It was her husband, John. And he was letting her know that this lamp that they'd had their eye on was on sale. But he was all hung up at work, and so he asked if she would take their 6-year-old son, Adam, with her and go down to Sears to buy one. She agreed to go, and she put shorts, a polo shirt, flip-flops, and an oversized captain's hat on Adam. And the two of them drove the 2 miles to the mall.
Wait, like a little sailor captain's hat? Or is that like something else I don't know about in the 80s?
I think so, yeah. I think so.
That's like a little
sailor hat. Yeah. As they walked inside the north entrance doors of the mall, Adam saw a display of the video game Asteroids, like with a group of boys taking turns playing a demo. And he begged his mom to let him play while she shopped around, and she said that he could. This was a really familiar store. She came here often. It was in their small community. She was so comfortable here at this store that she had a preferred parking spot in the Sears parking lot. Like, she's this is my spot. So she gave her son a kiss and left him to play his video game while she went to look at the lamps. That location ended up being sold out of the lamp that she wanted, which was a big bummer. So the clerk just took her information down and told her that they'd call her as soon as one came in. And with that, Reve went to go back and get Adam. She could hear the exploding spaceship sounds, but when she got back to the Asteroids game, the area was completely empty. None of the boys were there, including Adam. Reve told herself not to panic. She searched the store for him. She went back to her car, thinking maybe he went to wait for her there, but he wasn't there. She had the store staff page Adam, and the amount of times my mom had to do that, or I would do that. I would go and have her page. She would
Man, I forgot about that. Like, no one's doing that anymore.
No, because you have cell phones now.
My mom loved it so much that she just gave me a pager. She could just page my ass all the time. That's what I had.
Well, the store staff paged Adam, but he never answered the call. Her mother-in-law, Jean, also happened to be shopping at the store, just a total coincidence. And so she was helping Reve look for him, too. They were searching all over the store, all in the parking lot. An hour and a half later of searching and paging, and Adam was nowhere to be found. Around 1:55 that day, Reve called the police to report her son missing. And she would never see him alive again.
Oh, no.
Her husband, John, arrived at the store around 3 p.m. and tried to calm his wife down, but he was also feeling the panic. The Hollywood, Florida Police Department came out and they took her statement and they put word out about the missing boy. When the store closed with no sign of their son, John went home and he came back to Reve's car with some of Adam's blankets and his pillow and some toys and books. And he like spread it all in the back seat of their car, making up like a little bed for Adam. And he left the doors unlocked just in case he'd like wandered away and he would come back to where the car was parked. Yeah.
Oh my God, that's the saddest thing.
I know. They left a note that could be read through the windows that said, "Adam, stay in the car. Mommy and Daddy are looking for you." Reve rode her bicycle up and down streets of their neighborhood calling Adam's name, and then rode back up to Sears to see if there was a sign of him that she had missed.
Oh my God! Code Adam, is that what this is?
It is. Code Adam was actually created by Walmart.
Oh, okay.
But it was probably named that in memory of Adam Walsh, okay. This boy.
I don't really know. I know I've heard that before.
Yeah, I never have heard of Code Adam, so that's interesting. Yeah, it seems like it's like for children that go missing in
a store.
In a store. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So Reve's riding her bike up and down the neighborhood. She's going back and forth to Sears. And I just think at this point, you feel so helpless. You have to be doing something. You can't just sit around. You can't go to bed.
What are you gonna do? Like sit at home and eat pizza and watch a show? Like, no.
Right. And if you slow down enough to stop, you just know that you're not going to be able to deal with the situation. So you just keep going. Your mind is focused on finding him. And that way your mind doesn't have to focus on alternative possibilities. She went back to the Sears, like riding her bike. It was 2 miles. She went up a set of fire stairs to the roof. She looked down the building's ventilation shafts. Meanwhile, John and some friends and neighbors went to the local golf course. It was like right pretty near the Sears. So they formed a human chain to search this golf course in case Adam somehow wandered over there. Crime Watch volunteers had.
Sorry.
He was 6 years old. He was six.
Oh.
Yeah.
Dang. Okay.
Crime Watch volunteers held a walking search of the city with the help of a police helicopter spotlight. In 1981, there was no national alert system like the Amber Alert. There was no databases of missing and exploited children. There was no missing children advertised on milk cartons. Like, there wasn't anything in place like that. The local news did broadcast the news of Adam's disappearance, and Miami TV stations even broke into regular programming and requested that people call in to report anything suspicious that might help find Adam. But Adam's father, John Walsh, he wanted to do more. At this point, it was clear Adam had been abducted. He had not wandered away. He was nowhere. And the person who took him might have left the area. So at this point, putting it on the local news might not be doing any good. He needed to get a farther reach. And John didn't have any experience with investigations or anything like that, but he did work at a local hotel managing the sales and marketing department. And he decided to use his skills in marketing to advertise a $5,000 reward to passengers at the Atlanta hub of Delta Airlines, since he had like a connection at this, like with this Delta Airlines. And that would be like over $16,000 reward in 2023.
Wow.
At the time, Atlanta was the second busiest airport in the world. It comes in a close second behind O'Hare in Chicago. I'm almost positive that that's still true today. That airport is an absolute nightmare. So it was a good place to try and get the word out. You get a lot of eyeballs in Atlanta. Yeah. And eventually, flyers were being passed out to passengers on every airline in every airport in the United States. I don't know how long it took to get that in place.
Yeah, I was just thinking, like, flyers passed out. It's like the first time I've heard of, like,
yeah.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Doing it that way. Me too. 72 hours went by and there were no leads, but it doesn't seem like that's from a lack of effort. 22 Hollywood police officers volunteered unpaid overtime to keep looking for Adam. The Florida Game and Freshwater Fish Commission donated one of their helicopters for use in searching waterways. Revay even underwent hypnosis to try to remember some small detail that might help them locate her son, but no new information resulted.
Oh, I bet the guilt she's feeling too. I mean, like, not her fault, but again.
Definitely. I mean, even today, if there was a group of boys at a Sears playing a demo of Asteroids, I would probably let my kid play the game while I went and checked on the lamp, and then I'll come right back. Like, he's with a group. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, maybe I wouldn't, but...
That's why we don't have kids, girl.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't have kids, so I really don't know what I would do.
Right. That's why everyone that has kids today is yelling at us, like, no, don't do that.
Yeah, but I also think 2023 is a lot different than 1981 in the terms of you're locking the front door and making your kids play until the streetlights come on, you know?
Right, yeah. And I mean, 2023, a six-year-old's basically got a cell phone, so.
Right. Close to the 96-hour mark, a woman named Marilyn Pottenberger called the police to report that her son Timothy had witnessed something suspicious at the Sears the same afternoon that Adam Walsh disappeared. He'd seen a child fitting Adam's description being pulled into a dark blue van in the parking lot. She wouldn't let police talk to Timothy right away because he had severe migraines and she wanted his doctors to okay it first. But regardless, it was the one tip police had gotten, and they ran with it, announcing it as their first solid lead, despite there being some inconsistencies in the statement. And they put the call out to anyone who'd seen a blue van to contact police. Crime Stoppers even stage a reenactment of the suspected events with this blue van, which was aired on every TV station in Broward, Dade, and Palm Beach counties. Mm-hmm. So as you can imagine, this kind of led to somewhat of a witch hunt. Police and Florida state troopers just started pulling over hundreds of blue vans and searching them. And after 8 days of this, they realized they were often stopping the same blue van more than once. Like, they'd already searched all the blue vans and multiple times some of them.
Was it like a work van? Like, kind of like what you think of like the white van? Or is this like a truly like a Honda Odyssey, like minivan?
I don't know that the kid was that descriptive of what kind of blue van it was. I'm not sure. But the HPD ended up pulling back and realized maybe they should investigate this tip a little bit more before they just take the word of this child that this was definitely a blue van. And it was like not even taking the word of the child. It was taking the word of the mother of the child without even speaking to the actual witness who said that he saw this. On August 7th, 1981, Detective Joe Matthews came on the picture in this investigation. He was the chief polygraph examiner for Miami Beach Police Department. He also owned a school for polygraph examiners. So he, like, really knew what he was doing with polygraphs. Yeah. And he'd been requested to come in to help polygraph and interview people related to the case. Detective Jack Hoffman was the lead detective on the Adam Walsh case. And he was not thrilled about Detective Matthews coming in to help. And actually, throughout this entire case, he didn't seem to want any help from anybody. He would often refuse assistance on this case.
Bad blood?
I don't think so. I think it was ego. I think he wanted to be the one to solve it and didn't want anybody else stealing his credit or something. Like, he just was not accepting help.
Kid involved.
Right. And the biggest problem with this is that Detective Hoffman wasn't a good detective. His work style verged on chaos. He was not a detail-oriented person. And, like, same, but I'm not a detective responsible for, like, recovering a child that's been abducted.
But you are, like, kind of low-key a detective. With this, right? Mm. I don't know.
Definitely not. I take limited amounts of information and make wild theories. You know, that's I'm just like every other asshole out there.
So conspiracy theorist. Got it.
I try not to be, but you go down rabbit holes and you get there. But any suggestion that Detective Matthews, the polygraph guy, anytime he offered a suggestion on how to improve this investigation, Hoffman would shut it down. So Matthews polygraphed John Walsh, and he discovered someone in Walsh's circle that might have had a grudge against him. It was this guy named Jimmy Campbell, who'd been a pool boy at a hotel that Walsh had worked at in the past. And when Walsh started moving up in the hotel industry, he'd invited Jimmy to move into his spare room under the agreement that Jimmy would stay in school at the local community college and, like, help out around the house.
Mm.
Well, Jimmy dropped out of school a few months before this abduction, and Walsh had kicked him out of the house. So Detective Matthews interviewed Jimmy, and he discovered that there was actually another reason that Jimmy had left the house. Apparently, Jimmy had been having an affair with Ravee Walsh, with John's wife, Adam's mom. He'd moved out of the house because he felt so guilty for betraying his friend. This is according to Jimmy.
Right.
I don't know if there was any validity behind this, but that's what he said. So I don't know why he would make that up. But Detective Matthews gave Jimmy a polygraph, and he determined that Jimmy had nothing to do with the disappearance, that he was just worried about this affair becoming public information, which we've said it before. Polygraphs are not, like, you can't even use them in court as evidence. They're not, like, 100% accurate. So
junk science.
Well, and I don't know how you, if they're showing deception because they are afraid about this affair coming public, I don't know how you tell the difference between that and having been involved in this. But apparently, Jimmy,
you're nervous. Like,
you
know, you're being dishonest about something. So you're definitely feeling like a little bit, your heart rate's up, you're sweating a little bit. Like,
right. And so it seems like Detective Matthews kind of chalked up that nervousness into, like, he explained it away by saying, well, he's just nervous about this affair, and said he didn't have anything to do with the abduction. So I'm not a polygraph expert like Detective Matthews is. So I just would need to, you know, probably learn a lot more about it before I really understood how that worked. But Jimmy also had a very strong alibi that had been corroborated. And so based on that, Detective Matthews ruled him out as a suspect. But do you know who did not rule Jimmy Campbell out as a suspect? Detective Hoffman, the lead detective.
Yeah.
Despite the alibi, despite the polygraph results, Hoffman, he had a gut feeling that Jimmy was guilty. And he considered Jimmy his prime suspect. And I think the only thing he had to go on at this point was motive, like potential motive, like wanting to get back at John for kicking him out of the house.
Meanwhile, are they still trying to locate Adam or his body? Like, is that still?
Yeah, I don't think they're doing, like, heavy searches anymore at this point.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the searches have continued because they don't have anywhere to look. Like, they
– yeah.
The crime scene is not where he is, so they don't have any other leads on where to search for him. But – that said, on August 10th, 1981, fishermen found a head in a canal along the Florida Turnpike. I know.
What?
I know. This was about 130 miles away from Hollywood, and divers were now in the water searching for additional remains. John and Ravee were in New York. They were about to go on Good Morning America to offer a $100,000 reward for their son and to discuss other missing children's cases, asking for tips. So the police called John that morning before he went on Good Morning America to tell him about this discovery. But they said they weren't yet certain that it was Adam, and they would need his dental records to rule him out.
Oh, God. So sad.
I know.
I mean, you're definitely, like, also getting a new hobby. Like, you're not fishing anymore, right? No. Like, you're done. No. You're like, yeah, I'm going to take up golf, right?
Yeah.
Like,
no.
It's terrible.
Ugh, definitely. I know. So the producers at Good Morning America, they told John that he could cancel his appearance, but he decided to go on. He was hopeful that his son was still alive, that this wasn't Adam, and he wanted to take this opportunity to also talk about the other missing children. But before his interview, a close friend of the Walshes was able to identify the remains as Adam Walsh. Late that evening, John and Reve got the call about the positive identification, and they just broke down.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Detective Hoffman was making a real mess of this investigation. He was still certain that Jimmy Campbell was the killer. And this, I keep wanting to say Jimmy Kimmel.
I know.
Jimmy Campbell. Jimmy Kimmel. He was still certain that Jimmy Campbell was the killer. And this definitely seems like it's another case of an incompetent detective who wants an easy close. Mm. Hoffman got Jimmy to agree to a second polygraph. But when Detective Matthews, the polygraph expert, arrived to complete this polygraph, he walked in to see Hoffman in an interview room just like yelling at Jimmy. And so Matthews took Jimmy out of that room. He gave the polygraph as planned. But in the middle of the session, the assistant chief of police interrupted to tell Matthews about the discovery of Adam's remains. And this assistant chief of police told Detective Matthews that they knew Jimmy Campbell was guilty and that Matthews needed to get a confession. But even after the second polygraph, Matthews did not believe that Jimmy was being deceptive, and he wasn't going to be bullied into saying otherwise. He didn't think that he did it, so he wasn't going to coerce this confession they wanted out of him.
Good for him. I mean, I don't know what's the right answer, but coercion is never it.
Correct. Yeah, I'm like, I don't know if he did it or not, but coercing a confession is not how you catch the bad guy. The coroner determined that Adam's cause of death was asphyxiation. The manner of death was homicide. The time of death was estimated to be 10 days prior to the day that he was found. I'm not going to give the gruesome details here. I'll link the sources for those interested. All I'll say is the removal of his head most likely occurred after he was already dead.
I do have a question, though, mm-hmm. not to be into the details, but how are you determining the cause of death
with
when the head has been removed? Because to me, I'm like, I see that. I'm like, oh, this is his cause of death. But obviously, you're saying that occurred after. I mean, is it just like all science? I mean, obviously, the answer is yes, it's all science. But like, it's been submerged. It's, I don't know. I just like don't understand how they're like able to determine that. Like, especially if it's, I can't even say that word, asphyxiation. Ugh.
I'm sure the answer like, is out there and that? I just don't have the details because I would assume that there were markings of some kind maybe on his neck.
That's really sad.
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. But I will say, since the rest of the remains were still missing, these results were considered preliminary. So
yeah,
they weren't like definitive. This was the preliminary results of the autopsy. The results of the examination led the coroner to believe that the murderer had used a machete or a bladed weapon that was at least 5 inches long, and that the force used would have required two hands on the handle. No other evidence was found at the scene of the discovery, leading the police to believe that the murder had taken place elsewhere or that there were multiple scenes and that this was probably just a dumping ground.
How far was that, sorry, from the Sears?
I believe it was like 130 miles. Oh, yeah, wow. 130 miles away from Hollywood. Mm-hmm.
It's like 2 hours.
Yeah, yeah. Meanwhile, a media circus ensued and the Walshes planned Adam's funeral, but they couldn't bury his remains because the investigation remained active. And in fact, the remains would remain in the morgue until 2008.
Oh my God. That was a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. Yeah. Well, very long time. That's like pretty
recently.
The
80s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have no concept of time as we've.
Right. The day after Adam's remains had been found, a psychologist named Dr. Mark Reisner, who sometimes worked with police in Los Angeles, he offered an unsolicited profile of the likely murderer. And I just include this in here because it's kind of interesting when you see who the suspects become later on. So just kind of keep it in mind. But some highlights are that this person is most likely male, between 19 and 35, but most likely early 20s, Caucasian or maybe Latin, borderline psychopathic, psychotic personality with a powerful homosexual conflict, ultimately expressed in rage and violence. That's a direct quote from this guy. He'd be a loner, He'd be liked by very few people. He probably bragged about his crime to others.
He'd like, have, how are we getting all that? Like,
yeah, I don't know.
You know, like that just,
I don't know. There's a lot of stuff about behavioral science and how a lot of it is just kind of guesswork based on statistics. So, but he'd have no sense of remorse or guilt. It's unlikely that he would ever confess. He'd be of limited education, low socioeconomic status. If he was employed, he would work in manual labor. He'd identify with children due to a lack of growth emotionally and socially, and he'd have a history of other crimes against children.
Life doesn't happen biweekly, so why should payday? The money you've already earned can be in your hands today with EarnIn. I don't know about you, but I've been in that situation where I have a bill due Tuesday, but payday isn't until Friday. I've already earned the money, I've worked the hours, but because I have to wait on payroll, I'm now risking getting slapped with a late fee. But my options aren't great. I could pay with a credit card that has a high interest rate, or worse, get a payday loan that comes with steep fees and high interest. But now, there's a much-needed alternative out there with EarnIn. EarnIn is a way to access the money you've already earned that you might need before payday hits. It isn't an advance or a payday loan, no high interest rates, no steep fees. They're helping millions of Americans to feel self-sufficient without falling into debt traps. And it's so easy to use. Just download the EarnIn app and verify your paycheck, then access up to $100 a day as you work and leave an optional tip. Any money you access plus tips are automatically repaid from your next paycheck. Download EarnIn today, spelled E-A-R-N-I-N, in the Google Play or Apple App Store. When you download the EarnIn app, type in Creepers under podcast when you sign up. It'll really help the show. Creepers under podcast. Subject to your available earnings, location, daily max, and pay period max. See EarnIn.com/TOS for details. EarnIn is a financial technology company, not a bank. Bank products are issued by Evolve Bank and Trust, member FDIC. Anyone that knows me knows I'm obsessed with hair care and more recently skincare, but it is so overwhelming. It's hard to even know where to begin. And I hear about all these custom beauty products promising to fix my dry hair and scalp, my damaged ends. But then I find out that after you take some quiz to get it personalized, it turns out they're just sending you some pre-made formula that's not actually personalized. Well, that is not the case with Prose. Prose is here to make all your hair care and skincare wants and needs so easy. And it's actually personalized. Each and every bottle of Prose custom hair and skincare is made to order and personalized with a unique blend of naturally powerful and proven effective ingredients to meet your needs. Nothing is pre-mixed and straight off the shelf, and it's actually effective. In a third-party, double-blind, dermatologist-supervised, controlled clinical study, aka the gold standard in research studies, Prose proved that personalization works better than products straight off the shelf. You can try it for yourself and get your healthiest hair in 30 days or get your money back. In fact, Prose is so confident that you'll love your results that they're offering our listeners an exclusive trial offer so that you can see the difference that custom care can make. 50% off your first subscription order at prose.com/creepers. That's prose.com/creepers for your free consultation and 50% off of your one-of-a-kind formula. Prose.com/creepers.
The profile was interesting. It wasn't very useful at the time because the Walshes didn't know anyone. The Walshes didn't know anyone that fit that criteria. So it didn't like lead them to a suspect, but it was interesting.
They're not like, oh, it's Uncle Todd.
Right. You know? I would think that if you had an Uncle Todd that fit this description, he'd already be like suspect number one.
Yeah, he's already not getting invited to family affairs.
Right. Exactly. I hope not. I don't know. It's the 80s. It's kind of when you just like ignore the uncle. Kind of
creepy uncle.
Yeah. And it was just like, oh, he's just a creepy uncle. Like everybody has one and not
creepy
like
Uncle Todd.
Oh, maybe let's stop inviting him over.
Let's stop forcing our kids to hug him.
Yeah. Yeah. That's like a less of a thing now, which is great.
Yeah.
It seems that Detective Hoffman was finally getting around to doing some work, like actual police work. And by that, I mean, he went to interview people like the employees at Sears unsure what he'd been doing this whole time or why he waited so long.
Yeah, that feels like a day two situation.
That's like a day one. I'm on the scene. I'm talking to the employees at Sears while Adam is still a missing person.
Yeah, that should have been the
first thing he did. Yeah. Like, that's like, you got a checklist. The first thing, interview witnesses.
First thing, put on gloves. Second.
Okay, you're right. I don't understand. This guy sucks. Is my opinion. In my opinion, this guy sucks.
Yeah.
He spoke to a security guard at the Sears. This was 17-year-old Kathy Schaefer, who said that she had seen a group of boys fighting over the Atari game that day, like slapping each other over this game. So she came over to tell them all to knock it off, and they were talking back to her, so she told all the kids to leave. And she said one of the kids looked to be about 7, and he was wearing green shorts and a white shirt, and he left through the north entrance, which led into the parking lot. But when she was shown a photograph of Adam, she couldn't say for certain if it was him or not. Hoffman next spoke to Marilyn Pottenberger, which is the woman whose son Timothy said that he saw the blue van, the child being taken into the blue van that day. And they also talked to Timothy's grandmother, Carolyn Hudson. But the timing of their trip to Sears would put the blue van incident happening at like 1:25, which was an hour after Revae had already noticed Adam missing, which meant their only lead maybe wasn't even a lead at all. So just 3 months after the abduction and murder, this case went cold. Mm. But then a new lead basically fell into their laps. There was this guy, Otis Tool, and he is a tool, so it fits. He was also a drifter who had recently been convicted of 2 arsons in Jacksonville, Florida, and sentenced to 20 years in prison for those.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Tool also happened to be the lover of a serial killer named Henry Lee Lucas, who became famous after falsely confessing to like 600 murders to the Texas Rangers. Like, he was a serial killer, but he did not kill 600 people.
But
and he
not
just
that. Yeah.
Like kept confessing to all these things. Throughout all these confessions, he had implicated Tool in multiple murders. So a detective from the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office went to interview Tool, who was in prison for these arsons at that time. So very conveniently stuck there to be interviewed.
How would that have been?
How would what have been?
Why would he be involved if he was in prison? Are you saying he was out?
He had very recently been in prison for these arsons. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Very recently. So a detective from the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office went to interview him. And during this interview, Tool also confessed to a third arson that had resulted in a person's death. And this confession started an avalanche of confessions. So just like Henry Lee Lucas, confessions just start pouring out of this guy's mouth.
Mm.
And one of those confessions should have been very interesting to detectives in Hollywood, Florida. Tool confessed to abducting a little boy at a Sears with the intention of keeping him, but he couldn't stand it when the boy started crying, so he'd killed him and used a machete to dismember him.
That's very specific.
Yeah. He said he'd disposed of the head and body in different locations in the waterways of South Florida. These detectives interviewing Tool, they were named Kendrick and Terry. And they called Hollywood PD once they'd put this story together with the Adam Walsh disappearance. And it took a week for Hollywood police to call them back. And nothing seemed to come out of this call. They didn't go. They didn't, like they just weren't interested in this confession at all.
What?
Yeah. And I'm like, okay, I get it that the guy is just like confessing to everything under the sun, but
right.
Don't you think you should go talk to him if he's saying that he did it and he's having these details? And I don't know what was
or like pick up the phone
like before a week.
Okay, you're maybe not going to travel, but like pick up the phone and then decide if you want to like.
Yeah. Right.
I don't know. You got nothing else going on.
Well, and that's what I'm like, what else are you doing? I mean, I get that this is probably not their only case, but
yeah,
this is a really big one. Like,
right. Wouldn't you want to try and maybe like solve this?
Or are you just so hung up on Jimmy Campbell being the murderer that you're not interested in other suspects?
I'm never going to understand that.
No,
even if you are so sure it's Jimmy.
If you've got a guy in prison confessing to it, maybe somebody has to say.
And if he's a total crock of shit, then you've ruled him out. And then that just makes Jimmy that much more of a suspect.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. We should be detectives.
I know. I thought we already were.
But then Tool confessed again to Adam Walsh's murder. And the detectives interviewing him this time noted that Tool was very calm. But then once he started confessing to this murder and talking about it, he became anxious and tearful and distressed.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So once again, they call Hollywood PD. And this time, Detective Hoffman decided to drive up to Jacksonville and interview Tool himself.
Okay.
But then he gets there and he immediately accuses these detectives, Kendrick and Terry, of leaking case details to him. So that's why he's confessing to this. You told him about this stuff, which obviously pissed off those detectives. And
yeah,
one of them, Terry, he decided to sit in on Hoffman's interview with Tool, probably because he's like, this guy's not going to make a crap about me.
Yeah.
This time when Tool told his story again, he added distancing details. Like he said that Henry Lee Lucas, that serial killer that he was friends with, he said that he was present when they decided to take Adam. And that was a big change from his last confession.
Yeah.
And also couldn't possibly be true because Henry Lee Lucas was in prison at the time of this abduction. But Hoffman showed Tool two pictures of Adam Walsh. And with the first, Tool couldn't confirm that that was the boy that he had taken from Sears. But when Hoffman showed him the second photo, which was Adam with wet hair, Tool said that he looked like the boy. Hoffman ended the interview there and left, but Terry stayed behind and he asked Tool why he was lying, since they both knew that Henry Lee Lucas had been in prison and could not, he was in jail in Maryland and could not have been there at this abduction. And so Tool admitted that he lied and he asked to talk to Hoffman again. And so when they re-interviewed him, Tool said that he had lied to try to get even with Lucas for abandoning him. I don't really want to get into their whole thing.
Yeah.
But Hoffman asked Tool if he'd be willing to show them the crime scenes, hoping that Tool could help them find the rest of Adam's remains. And Tool reluctantly agreed. He did end up identifying a dock as the location where he disposed of Adam's remains, and this was only a few yards away from where it had been discovered by the fishermen. But nothing else that Tool said or showed them led to finding anything else or any other evidence.
Dang.
And so I gotta kind of assume that that might be the one location that maybe was public knowledge. Like, I don't know what information had been released.
Right.
But if any information had been released, it would probably have been where these fishermen were when they found, you know, the remains.
Right. I feel like they definitely haven't fine-tuned that back then. We're still releasing that info now, so.
Right. So, I mean, it is possible that everything he's saying could be public knowledge. Like, I'm sure it was out there that he'd been taken from Sears, that it was in Hollywood. Yeah. Like, I'm sure he knew all of that, so. I don't know. That evening, the Hollywood chief of police, Sam Martin, publicly announced that Adam Walsh's killer had been found and they would be charging him the next day. The chief stated that Tool knew things that no one else could know, like details about the weapon used in the crime, the location of the dock. So maybe that hadn't been released. But there was a little problem with this announcement. The chief of police doesn't actually get to decide who gets charged with a crime. That's up to the state's attorney. And charging Tool would start a clock that the state's attorney wasn't ready to start. Since Tool was already in prison for the arsons, they kind of just wanted to wait until they gathered more evidence against him, like physical evidence that placed Tool at the scene, preferably, or at least linked him in some way to this crime. Because right now, the case against him is very weak. They have his confession, where he also confessed to a smattering of other things. He changed his story a couple of times. He already admitted that he lied once. So they don't really have a strong enough case.
Right.
Because I think it's like, because we have a right to a speedy trial, once you get charged, you only have a certain amount of time to build your case against the person.
Right.
So I think that's kind of what they're talking about
there. Speedy is relative, though.
I mean, Yes, I totally agree.
Sometimes I'm like, what? This is still going.
Well, I think a lot of times when it's like years later, that's the defense continually putting in motions to delay or whatever. But sometimes it isn't the defense. And it's like, what is taking so long? Like, what? Like, I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't know, like, the specifics of, like, what the actual rules are. I'm sure it varies by state. I don't really know. But this announcement about Tool, so the chief of police gets up, he's like, we have our killer. It did lead to some new witnesses that could place Tool at that Sears on the day of the abduction. There was Arlene Mayer, who had been there with her daughter. And when her daughter saw Tool's photo in the paper, she stopped in her tracks. Someone had tried to kidnap her that day. They'd even called the police to report it the day that it happened, though nothing ever came of that call. And her daughter recognized the man in the paper as the person who had tried to kidnap her.
Oh, my God.
I know. So once again, Arlene called the police and reported this and gave a statement. And when she told Hoffman that she had called police that day that it happened, he said he couldn't locate any record of that call. But it seems like he wasn't great about writing stuff down, you know.
Yeah, of course.
Not detail-oriented. This is why I can't be a detective. I also am not detail-oriented.
Or target customer service, because they never have record of my call either.
Well, there's a story there. There was also another witness named Bill Missler. He also saw the news about Tool's connection to the Adam Walsh case. Bill had also been at the Sears that day. He'd also seen Tool there that day. But this news story made it seem like the case was basically finished. Like, case closed. We caught him. We found him. He's going to get charged.
No.
So he didn't think that his statement was really needed, and he had a criminal history himself. So he decided not to call and report this and get involved in the case.
I feel like that makes it more credible.
I agree. I know. I don't know how that came out later, but yeah. Hoffman then started leaning more on Tool, trying to trace his whereabouts before and after the abduction and murder, trying to tie him to somewhere in South Florida. Tool told him that he had gotten money from the Salvation Army in Newport News, Virginia, to buy a ticket back to Jacksonville, Florida. And once he was in Jacksonville, he'd gone to this business called Reeves Roofing to see if he could do a job there and earn some money. I think he had a history with this company. Or maybe he went by the boarding house where his wife, Rita, lived. He couldn't remember exactly what he had done. Hoffman told him that his timeline mattered here, and he pressed him to remember. And then Tool just recanted his whole story, saying he'd made the whole thing up. And Hoffman was like, oh, okay. And he left.
What? Hello?
He's like, oh, you lied. Okay. And he just took off and left.
Detective 101.
Right. But then Tool told Terry, that other detective, that actually he'd lied when he said that he'd lied. So Terry called Hoffman back once again. And like at this point, I get it. You cannot take this guy's confession seriously. Like he is just doing too much.
But you got to look into it. Like you got to look into what he's saying.
Don't
you
just get up and walk out and leave. Yeah. But yeah. It's now his fifth interview regarding the Walsh case. And this time, Tool starts adding in new details. He said that he walked from the Greyhound station to the roofing company where his white Cadillac was stored after it had been repossessed. And since he'd been an employee there, he had keys to the property and he borrowed the car. And he drove to his mother's property. He dug up $300 that he'd buried there. He filled the tank in his Cadillac and he drove toward Miami. In the car, he had various tools, including a machete and a shovel. During this interview, Tool gave details on how he had murdered Adam by strangling him in an attempt to get him to stop crying. He also detailed the disposal, the return trip, and the cleanup. So they asked him why he'd recanted. Why had he said he'd lied? And he said he'd just been confused. Tool did have a mild intellectual disability. He had an IQ of like 75, which an average is 100. And he had only a seventh grade education. He also had epilepsy, and he had a childhood full of severe neglect, sexual abuse, physical abuse. So because of all of these factors, there are a lot of people that question the legitimacy of these confessions, especially when you add in his connection to Henry Lee Lucas, who, like, was famously confessed under police coercion to hundreds of murders that he had never committed.
It's like his criminal role model, you know?
Right. And so then people are like, okay, well, had the police coerced this confession by Tool? Yeah. And even if they hadn't, would anyone take this confession seriously, considering all the times that Tool claimed to be lying, then changed his mind and said he wasn't lying? Detective Hoffman really needed physical evidence, but he didn't seem to want to look too hard for any of it because he, like, never asked Arlene Mayer's daughter, who claimed to have nearly been a victim of Tool's. Like, never asked her.
Never talked to her.
Never, no. He did talk to several former cellmates who claimed that Tool had talked to them about murdering Adam and that he'd said that he was worried about others would do to him in prison if word got around that he'd killed a kid. Detective Hoffman did try to substantiate Tool's claims. He discovered that Reeves Roofing had kept a wooden machete on the property, a property that Tool might have had keys to at the time of the crime, and that machete had not been seen lately. He got several reports from people that had seen Tool carrying around a machete. He also confirmed that Tool wasn't working on the day of the abduction, so couldn't account for his whereabouts anywhere. But he couldn't find anything that proved where Tool actually had been that day either. So they knew where he wasn't, but they couldn't find any evidence to prove where he was. Then Hoffman struck gold. He'd heard that Tool had connections with this shop called Spencer's Motors. They'd known him since he was a teenager, so he went to go talk to the owner there. And the owner showed Hoffman some of Tool's belongings that he kept stored at the shop. Amongst the belongings was a machete that had what looked like a tarry substance smeared on it. So Hoffman sent it to be processed at the lab. Detective Terry, meanwhile, the detective in Jacksonville, he managed to track down Tool's white Cadillac, which was also sent to the crime lab to be processed for prints, blood, and fibers. The crime lab didn't end up being very helpful. This is limited technology in the 1980s.
Yeah.
They did find blood in the carpet and padding of the backseat floorboard, but there wasn't enough blood to, like, do any tests with the limited technology. Mm-hmm. The machete also had blood on it, but the testing was also inconclusive of that. And also, there were, like, five rolls of film that were taken of the car that seemed to, like, go missing. Nobody could find these, this film. And then Tool just continued his cycle of confess, recant, confess, recant. In his eighth statement to police, he told a Hoffman that he had brought Adam's body to the site where his mother's house had burned down. And there he burned everything related to the murder into ashes. And then he piled those ashes onto a blanket. And then he put that blanket, he bundled that blanket up, put the bundle into the trunk of the Cadillac. But then he realized that some of those ashes might still be burning embers. That could start a fire. So then he got a hose. He hosed the trunk of the Cadillac down. And then the next day, he drove out to the Jacksonville dump and dumped it all there. And he said he then returned the Cadillac to Reeves Roofing, left the machete at Spencer's Motors, where he kept a lot of his belongings. There were some inconsistencies with this story. I think they can be explained. The biggest was that he claimed that there were parts of Adam's body included in the burning of this evidence. But in another statement, he said that he dumped all the body parts at random, at, like, different places. But a lot of this story was verifiable, like the fact that Hoffman found that the water service was still connected at his mother's house, even after the arson. And so Tool would have been able to use a hose, like he said he'd had. But there was no hope of finding that bundle at the dump. At this point, it had been 2 years since Adam's murder.
It's gone.
Yeah. Hoffman was given the names and numbers of the employees that were working at the dump that day, but it doesn't appear that he spoke to them to confirm if they had seen Tool that day. It would have been nice for him to talk to them. I doubt it would have gone anywhere, but maybe one of them had, and you don't know if you don't talk to them.
Yeah, all of this, like, not talking. I mean, the ultimate, like, I'm just not going to check that, to me, is, like, no one talking to Dawn in the Haman Lee murder. But next, a second place, this is really...
For the employees of the Lens Crafters.
That's what I know. But this is really becoming something right here. Like, we're just not going to check in.
Yeah. Hoffman really struggled to get any actual evidence against Tool. Probably because he's, like, not really talking to people. But he tried. But there's also, like, every time he does try to get, like, the physical evidence, he hits a brick wall. He tried to test the machete against marks on Adam's body, but they came back negative. He also tried to match paint chips that were found on Adam to the white Cadillac, but that came back undetermined. He attempted to obtain tests to confirm whether tool markings on the spine of Adam matched this weapon. There was no trace evidence on the car linking Tool to the crime. The only thing they ever found was at Tool's mom's house when they excavated the site. This is like one of his arsons. The house was totally burned down. But when they excavated there, they did find yellow child-sized flip-flops and children's green shorts. But,
whoa.
Yeah. But then when Tool recanted his statement again, Hoffman once again took him at his word. He placed those shorts and flip-flops in an evidence room and never tested them.
Oh my God.
For 13 years, they just sat in an evidence locker untested. And now later, like much, much later, Reve Walsh was shown these pieces of clothing and said that that wasn't what Adam was wearing that day or that she didn't recognize the clothing.
Yeah, but still.
But still. No, I agree. You test it. Because what if that was another kid? It's buried in the yard of his mother's house.
Yeah, it's still concerning.
It's still concerning. The case went cold, and Hoffman just became convinced that Tool was not involved in this murder. Well, I get that he wasn't fine. I'm not convinced that he was not involved. I'm not 100% sure that it was him either, but I'm certainly not convinced that it wasn't him.
In my opinion, I'm not convinced that this man should be a detective. That's what I'm just going to say.
Is he
still around? I don't need to get an email from him, but...
This is the early... I mean, we've been there, done that.
I know.
I get that he wasn't finding a whole lot of physical evidence, but everything he was finding was fitting. And it's not like he was finding evidence supporting any other theory. Like, it's not... So the evidence he's getting is not pointing away from Tool. It's just not proving him either. You know what I mean?
I'm just dying that we literally, like, give the authorities performance reviews. You know? We're like,
somebody has to.
You would shine better elsewhere in a different role.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure there's a used car lot with your name on it.
Wawa's always hiring. No, you can't go work there.
And they pay cash. They pay you cash.
Yeah, they do.
I think he was just over this guy constantly recanting everything he said. And Hoffman just started publicly stating that he didn't think Tool was the guy. The last piece of work that Hoffman did for this investigation was to, again, throw accusations at Detective Terry, the one in Jacksonville, saying that he'd fed details to Tool because the two had made a pact to write a book together. This is what he's accusing him of. Yeah. In 1988, Otis Tool did start trying real, real hard to profit off of this crime, whether he did it or not. He wrote a letter to John Walsh saying that he would tell him where Adam's remains were in exchange for money.
Oh my God.
The letter was nasty.
Leave this family alone.
Yeah. It was full of horrific details that were intended to torment the Walshes.
Yeah.
So John Walsh immediately contacted the police. Tool's signature matched his signatures on forms from the prison, but Hoffman simply filed this letter away, thinking this was just Tool trying to get attention.
Oh my God. Tool, I'm going to lose it.
I know.
I'm flipping tables over here.
I know.
I haven't flipped tables in years, in at least a year.
I know. It's enraging.
Are you appalled by everything?
I'm appalled by everything. Tool also sent letters to Sears claiming that he would go public okay. about how easy it was to abduct children from their stores, as well as national media outlets. But no one took the bait. So he got no
really
money
think it's, like,
from anybody.
Specific to Sears.
No. No. It's
they're not like a school or like a daycare where their responsibility is to keep kids long term for the day, you know?
Right. Right. This whole horrific experience gave the Walshes a newfound purpose in life. They were determined to prevent this type of situation from ever happening to other families. And this just gives me chills. Like, this is why we're talking about this case today. They started out by founding a small nonprofit that they called the Adam Reach Outreach Center for Missing Children. They lobbied Congress to create legislation supporting the Missing Children's Act, which passed in 1982. That established a national database to help find missing children and to find the names of the unidentified dead.
Yeah.
They produced a TV movie called Adam about the case. And at the end of the movie, they showed images of 55 missing children. Because of this, 13 of those children were reunited with their families.
Stop it. Really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. I know. And that's not it. Like, we're just beginning. I know. The Walshes then created a national version of their small nonprofit. This is one you might have heard of. It's called the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children.
I have heard of that. That's from them?
This is them. They started that.
Oh, my gosh.
The organization was funded by a $3.3 million grant, which would be like $9 million today, by the U.S. government on the condition that John Walsh would serve on the board of directors and dedicate his time 100% to this organization. And it would be a big pay cut, but Walsh agreed. Then in 1985, Walsh also had a role in helping bring VICAP into being, which is the Violent Crime Apprehension Program. This is a tool that the FBI and law enforcement use to identify repeat violent offenders. Before this, there wasn't any really good system of linking a person to multiple crimes.
Yeah.
John Walsh testified at like a Senate subcommittee hearing, and eventually they got the funds to start the system. Then in 1987, Fox approached John Walsh to host a new television series called America's Most Wanted.
Wait, that's that John Walsh?
Uh-huh.
Shut up. This is his son.
Uh-huh.
What?
Uh-huh.
You sneaky little dog.
I'm so sneaky. I know.
I didn't know that the John Walsh. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, that's why he did it. That's why he did it.
Holy cow.
I know. He'd become pretty high profile with all of his advocacy work for victims and children. And even though he'd never acted or been a television personality before, Fox insisted that he was the perfect person for the job.
Yeah, because he was given that God-given voice.
I know. This was one of the first reality TV shows. It ran for 25 seasons until it was canceled in 2013. As a result of America's Most Wanted, over 750 fugitives have been captured and 36 children have been recovered alive.
That's alive. That's what's crazy.
Mm-hmm. And also through this show, John Walsh came into contact with Joe Matthews, the polygraph examiner and detective from early on in the case. Matthews had come across a case that he wanted Walsh to air on his show. This was the murder of 21-year-old Jason McMahon. It was America's Most Wanted's first cold case. And together, they were able to solve this case.
What?
Matthew, yes. It ended up being a football player at
this
university.
This is too much for me.
I know. Matthews became a friend of John Walsh's, and he continued to look into the Adam Walsh case. But anytime he'd start digging, he'd get stonewalled by Detective Hoffman and the Hollywood Police Department.
Yeah.
And it just started really looking, in my opinion, like they were trying to cover up how botched this investigation was.
21 years after Adam's murder, there was still no justice for him. No. An Alabama newspaper made a request through the Freedom of Information Act that the file on the Adam Walsh case be made public. And this was a big problem because the case was still unsolved and open. And releasing the information in the file could make it impossible to ever solve the case.
Right. So you're going to get just flooded with false info.
Yeah. And then John Walsh is also dealing with all these conspiracy theory rumors that range from he had somehow obstructed the investigation on purpose, or there was rumors that he was connected to the mafia and this murder was in retaliation for a drug deal gone bad.
This boy was abducted in a Sears. This doesn't have mafia written on it.
No, it sure doesn't.
In a Florida Sears, nonetheless.
Sears, right. So Walsh asked for help from HPD for both of these issues, to help squelch these wild rumors, as well as to deny this Freedom of Information request. But the chief of police declined to help him on either subject. He seemed to believe that Walsh actually was affiliated with the mob because of this place that he there was this place that he liked to go to lunch pretty frequently.
Olive Garden?
Yeah. I don't know where it was. But apparently it was also frequented by the mob. And
definitely Olive Garden.
And he told John that he fully intended to grant this Freedom of Information Act request.
It's probably La Madeleine.
Definitely. That's like a very mob type place, La Madeleine. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Keep it down.
With your quiche Lorraine. And your tomato basil soup.
Basil.
So good.
Cold pesto pasta salad. Okay, we're done.
Your Caesar salad on the side.
You Caesar salad, have an
side
ass.
Caesar.
Low fat dressing, please.
So then Walsh went to the state attorney, who told him during this conversation that he hadn't known about that letter that Toole had written him. The state attorney had never heard of this letter. And he said that he thought he could have gotten a conviction on that letter alone. And so he agreed to help intervene, and he requested that this FOIA request be denied. But at the hearing, the judge ruled that it would be granted. I mean, I don't know the ins and outs of the Freedom of Information Act, but that seems like maybe that's not information that the public needs to have when it's an unsolved case. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. Walsh was so frustrated, and he was about to be dealt another blow.
Mm.
After 8 years on the air, America's Most Wanted was getting canceled. So,
what? Really?
Yeah, they tried to cancel this show after 8 years. Didn't work because Walsh decided that his last episode was going to be about Adam's case. And so he did an episode on Adam's case.
Did he get to choose?
I think it was like, he's the host. He like kind of created the show. He was the host of it. It was his show, really. I think he made a lot of the decisions about what they covered on this show.
I kind of assumed that was the first episode. I guess he never
did. Yeah, I don't think so. They never did it. But they did this last one. So this episode did insanely well. It received overwhelming support. People started like sending in letters, like trying not to get this show canceled. And it worked. They uncanceled America's Most Wanted.
Uncanceled.
The episode also brought in more information on Adam's case by getting a few more witnesses to come forward. One of those was Mary Hagen, who gave a statement that she had seen Toole at Sears on July 27th, 1981. And normally I would be like, how are you remembering seeing a random person at the mall? Like, I could never tell you who I saw yesterday at the airport. Yeah. But she gave the detail that Toole smelled like beer and onions and was rancid smelling. And those who had known him or ever been in a room with him confirmed that that was true. So maybe it was like that nasty smell that she remembered that stuck in her mind. And then Toole's niece, Sarah Patterson, came in to talk to police. And she told them that she had asked Toole whether or not he had killed Adam. And he had confirmed to her that he had. A man named Joel Cockerman called in, who said
he confirmed to Hoffman like 15 times and then unconfirmed. So, I mean,
Now all of a sudden we're taking a family member's word too?
No, I think this is just like one more person. I don't think anybody's taking anybody's word for anything. I think it's just like one more person to back up that it was him. Yeah. I don't know that that would hinge on just her saying that, but it's like one more person saying, helps. Hey, he told me that he did it. Yeah. A man named Joel Cockerman called in who said that he may have been one of the boys who had been ordered out of the store that day when they were playing that game.
Whoa, I forgot about them.
Yeah. He called in with a tip of seeing Tool that day, and his sister also saw that episode of America's Most Wanted, and she recognized Tool from the Sears as well. But then a part of me, especially with eyewitnesses, is like, how much of this is like biased confirmation, you know, like confirmation mm-hmm. bias, where like you're like, I was there that day. I did see that guy. You know, I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, eyewitness statements are just always so. I definitely
forgot about the other boys.
Yeah, I know. Well, yeah, how would you have remembered him? Nobody tracked them down.
Yeah.
Nobody bothered to.
So you don't know that anything.
Find out who they were.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm sure they could have pulled like receipts from around there. There's probably a lot of them that had parents that were shopping that day. I don't know.
Yeah.
Walsh received word in 1996 that Tool was dying in prison. And because he was dying, Walsh thought maybe he would want to clear his conscience. Even though he had said a million times he'd done it, and then he'd said a million times he hadn't, so.
Yeah.
He wanted to send Joe Matthews out to talk to him. But unfortunately, before Matthews could get there, someone called the America's Most Wanted tip line and said that Tool had died. He had hepatitis and AIDS. He died from cirrhosis of the liver. No one claimed his body, and he was buried on prison grounds.
I didn't know that was a thing.
But it was, yeah. Mm-hmm, yeah, they just bury you there if nobody comes to claim you.
Oh, God.
Yep. It was later learned that a prison administrator had heard Tool's deathbed confession of the worst thing he'd ever done in his life, and he said he had killed Adam Walsh, and he expressed remorse over it. Mm. I mean, I don't know. Why are you saying that at your deathbed? Or is this administrator making that up? Like, I don't.
I think you're clearing your conscience on your deathbed for sure.
Yeah.
I don't know why they'd make it up.
I don't know why they would make that up either. But people want to be involved.
Yeah.
Well, people want to be involved with cases. I don't know. But I think all of these people coming forward, I don't know. Maybe they're, again, well, it's been years and you're going to say you recognize this guy. But maybe if he like really creeped you out, if he was like this really creepy guy that smelled really bad. Maybe you remember what he looked like a little bit more. I don't know. Reveille Walsh asked Detective Matthews to pick up all the evidence that had been compiled so far and reinvestigate it all as a cold case. And in re-interviewing people who might have information, Matthews learned from John Reeves Jr. of Reeves Roofing, that Tool, that's the place where he had the Cadillac stored.
Mm-hmm.
So John Reeves Jr. also said that Tool had confessed this whole crime to him. No one had ever asked Reeves about that, so he just had never offered that up for whatever reason.
Okay, sir. We're asking the whole world about it. It's a national situation.
Right. And like, why are you passing out
flyers at an airport? Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
Reeve, but oh, right. This is why I forgot about this part. This is why.
Oh.
It turns out that Reeves had a book contract with Tool that had been created after Tool's first confession. And that agreed to give Reeves the rights to any films or books that were about Tool. And then they'd split any profits 50-50.
Boo.
Yeah. So Reeves even showed this document to Hoffman. I mean, it was like a whole contract that he had. So he showed it to Matthews. But obviously this is where Hoffman got the idea that Detective Terry had this book deal going with Tool. I don't know why. I don't know how he thought that it was Terry and not this guy, but that seems like a pretty big coincidence that, like, Hoffman's accusing this detective of having this book contract, and then it turns out that there actually is a guy with a book contract. I don't know. It seems like Hoffman was confused. He probably didn't write something down like he should have. It's the details. It's those details.
Yeah, the details. Cool.
Matthews also reexamined all the physical evidence, and he found what he felt was the proof he needed to know that Tool had committed this crime.
Oh, tell me.
To him, this was the smoking gun. This was for sure. I'm not so sure. There were photos of the illuminated blood on the carpet, like lit up, like blue, like luminol.
Yeah.
And they were in the shape of shoe prints. And these shoe prints went directly with a story that Tool had told about changing his shoes after he'd gotten blood on them. There was also photos of the machete that showed when the black electrical tape had been removed from the handle that it had been soaked in blood. But the final piece, the one that really got Matthew's gears going, was a photo of the luminol-enhanced carpet from behind the driver's side of the white Cadillac. There,
behind the driver's side. Okay.
Yeah, like on the floorboard, the carpet of the car. There was the outline of a boy's face in this luminol that Matthews thought undeniably had belonged to Adam.
I don't know how you're telling it from that, but...
I did a Google search for these pictures. I didn't look too closely because I didn't want to. I didn't see what he saw. It wasn't like so obvious to me, but I don't know. Maybe other people see it. I don't know.
I thought you were like, there's not a lot of details in this one. And now I'm really thinking about them.
I didn't give you almost any details. I didn't even tell you really how he died.
Baby.
I left a lot out. I know.
Well, thank you for
that. I don't think you need to know that. I think the things that I told you are things that you have to know.
Yeah.
Like, the things that I left out are things you don't need to know to understand the case.
I really liked when you thought I didn't need to know any of this about... like 2 years ago.
Told you a little bit. I left a lot. I did not talk about any of his confessions.
No, I just meant like before the podcast. I meant like before you thought I needed to join you here weekly. Just like we would hang out and talk about girl stuff. You know, like boys and booze and...
We would talk about crime stuff. Come on. We would talk about cases. I get you talking about it. We talk about Adnan. We talk about Richard Glossop.
That's true.
You were interested.
Damn it.
I lured you in.
I'm a cheap drunk on $5 sangria.
So after this like reinvestigation by Matthews, they closed Adam's case in 2008. And apparently the Walshes and law enforcement were both satisfied that Tool was responsible for Adam's murder. There are still a lot of doubts where this is concerned. There are a lot of people that believe wholeheartedly that Tool did not commit this murder.
I am not
The evidence against him is... No, I'm not either. So the evidence against Tool is circumstantial. He was a serial confessor, so it doesn't really seem like his word means anything. And there's not really a lot else against him. What they have seems to add up, like, and supports that it was him. But it certainly doesn't prove that he did it. There are a few other suspects I didn't go into because they were, like, dropped or cleared in some way or another. But, I mean, who knows if those people were cleared for... Don was cleared, too, you know?
Yeah, well...
There's even still people that say that Jimmy Campbell is a noteworthy suspect. There's a lot of people that think Jeffrey Dahmer was responsible for Adam Walsh's murder. I think there's a lot of people that like really think that Adam was one of Dahmer's victims. But I...
You know, I don't know who that is. Did he only kill kids?
He ate people.
Oh my God, what?
Yeah, he
cooked them up. No, he didn't.
Ate them.
Yep. Stop it. We're never doing that. We're never doing that. I don't need it. No. We're never doing that.
No. I decided that a long time ago. No.
Wait, isn't that one that's like really famous that people are like really into?
There's a people show. There's a like current show called Dahmer.
Yeah.
About him.
Yeah. I didn't know that about you.
Yeah.
Here are my two questions.
That's why there's this, the Eat My Heart Out like Jeffrey Dahmer in that Rihanna song. Eat your heart out like Jeffrey Dahmer, whatever
it is. I think you mean Katy Perry.
Katy Perry.
One, are Reve and John still together?
They were divorced, but then jointly dismissed their divorce. And as of October 11th, they were happily reconciled and committed to their marriage.
October 11th, like this year?
Sorry, October of 2011.
Oh,
And did they have any other kids?
Yes, they did. They had three more. They had Megan, who was born the year after Adam's disappearance, Callahan, who was born in 1985, and Hayden, who was born in 1994.
Callahan, love that.
I do too. I think it's just one of those things where we'll probably never know, like, for 100% sure what really happened that day. I do like thinking that the Walshes feel like this is the answer. And, like, they feel like they have the answers that they needed. And because of them, because of John and Reveille Walsh, Adam's legacy didn't have to be just a tragic cautionary tale, you know?
They've done so much good.
It became advocacy for others. And because of Adam, the way law enforcement investigates crime was completely changed. I mean, from America's Most Wanted and its lasting effect on crime to VICAP to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. I mean, they've just done so much good. On top of that, the case also inspired the Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act of 2006, which established a more thorough and accessible nationwide database of convicted sex offenders, increased penalties for crimes against children, and created the National Child Abuse Registry. The Walshes really took the absolute tragedy a parent can suffer and used that to help countless others. And yeah, the Adam Code Adam, that is generally believed to be named after Adam Walsh, is what Wikipedia said. So I don't know that it's 100%, but yeah, I think that was named after him.
I think it was before. I remember reading some of this. It was before the Amber Alert. And it's like, when you're in a store, if they say it, the employees, it like is a...
have to react in a certain way.
Yeah. They like that makes lock sense. All the doors. Like everyone's like in the store. Like all the doors are locked. I don't really remember. I never worked retail, but...
I did, and I was never trained on Code Adam, but I worked I worked in small stores. Yeah, I worked at
like one Gap exit, you know,
and Lacoste. Yeah, so the process: if a visitor reports a child is missing, they get a detailed description of them and what they're wearing. All exterior access to the building is locked and monitored. Anyone approaching a door is turned away. The employee goes to the nearest in-house telephone and pages Code Adam, describing the child. And then designated employees monitor front entrances. Other employees begin to look for the child. If they're not found within 10 minutes, law enforcement is notified.
Yeah.
If they are found, definitely they're named for him with their parents. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. It says it's generally regarded as having been named in memory of Adam Walsh.
I cannot understand their strength enough because I just don't know, that I would have it in me like, you know, they're like, we don't ever want any other parents to have to go through this. And I totally understand that. And I would never want that. But there's a part of me that would be like, why me? Why am I suffering through this? Why is no one else having to deal with this? And I just don't know that I could like. I wonder
if it's like that same part of them that couldn't stop looking for him that day, that had to be doing something, that had to be working towards something, because otherwise they would just be forced to like sit in it. And that was not good. So I wonder if that's like they just dove head in and this is how they were able to grieve and mourn and accept and
I want to believe I have that in their lives. You know, I want to believe I have
that in me. I know. I do too. I hear you.
Wow. That was so sad, but I'm so glad you told me that.
That's
such a good story.
That's why, I mean, I knew you'd know by the end why I wanted to do this story.
I really didn't know it was that John Walsh.
I knew you wouldn't.
But I caught Code Adam, like, kind of.
You did real early. I was really kind of freaking out when you brought that up, that you were going to be like, is this that John Walsh?
No, I don't know why that stuck out my brain. I don't know why.
Yeah.
Sidebar, though. How have we not talked about Richard Glossop? Let's just...
Oh, my God.
I know.
So SCOTUS. I mean...
Yeah, I know. This is like your
I have not been able to say thanks, SCOTUS, in several years. Yeah. Many a year. I know. They've been just daring me a new one. But I honestly am shocked that they actually, I don't know. I'm so relieved. So if you guys haven't heard Richard Glossop, the state, who, if you haven't heard his episode, it's number one. It's number 100. It's obviously a case that's very important to me.
Preferably listen to number 100, though.
I don't know. Number we got that great waterbed joke.
Yeah, number one's audio is rough.
But the state's attorney general had put in a motion, or whatever you call it, to the parole board, like the parole board, to give Richard Glossop a stay of execution. And the parole board denied it. And so he was going to be executed on May 18th, which is like coming in hot. This is after, I mean, after tons of evidence has come out, after a full investigation. Yeah, he's had like 4 or 5 execution dates.
Yeah.
Tons of information, new information has been uncovered in this case. Like, so they denied it. So it appealed. It went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court has stayed. I mean, we are not jumping up and down. It is not time to celebrate right now, but
right.
It's saving his life temporarily. So
I mean, we just do not need to kill this man. It's crazy to me.
It is crazy to me that we are thinking about, that we are actively planning to execute this person.
Yeah.
When we have no evidence that he did right. this. Just because he, yes, was found guilty. Because once you're found guilty.
You're guilty.
There's like almost nothing you can do.
But
almost
he was found guilty. Well, we don't have to. Go listen to episode 100.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. But anyways, exciting news. All right. We have shout outs. It's shout out time.
Shout out.
Oh, I'm excited for these shout outs today. Can I go first? Because this is the
best. Sure.
Major shouts to Breezy, like the wind.
Breezy. Easy breezy for you.
Easy breezy.
Thanks, Breezy.
Beautiful cover girl.
Breezy. I love that. I hope that's like your real name. I mean, it's cool if it's a nickname too, but that's
I think
awesome.
It is.
Yeah. Breezy. Maybe. Major Breezy. Shouts to Sarah. Oh, there you are. Major shouts to Sarah Hamilton. No phonetic spelling needed.
Nope, we got that.
Hope
Sarah
I got it right.
Hamilton. All right. Major shouts to Corina.
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 I love that name, except there was this girl in high school. Her name is Corina. I always thought she was coming for my man. But she was cute, so girl.
Jolene.
Game recognized game. Jolene. Corrine.
Game recognized
game. Sure, it's not
game.
This Corina.
It's definitely not this Corina. This Corina is a stand up girl's girl.
She's a stand up. You see what you did there?
I do. Mm. I do. Oh, she'll get it.
She knows.
Get it.
She knows.
She knows.
Heather Allgood. Heather Allgood. Heather rhymes with
Heather
feather.
Allgood.
These names, there's like a theme, like Breezy,
Breezy
Allgood.
Allgood. Yeah.
Okay, girl. I like that vibe. That's a Monday vibe.
That is the vibe we needed after this episode.
Yeah.
just did.
It's not all good.
We're feeling breezy. We're feeling all good. Which is great because we're about to go into recording this mini creep. That's going to be a breezy, all good mini creep, kind of.
Oh,
not
good.
Really. But it's going to be interesting, though. I'm very excited about it. Well, thank you so much. If you would like a shout out on the podcast, you can hop over, join our Patreon. We'll give you a shout out at any level. You just have to fill out a little form that tells us that you want a shout out so that we don't call you out if you don't want to. And also so we know how to pronounce your name. That's really the main thing.
Right. Yeah.
So
turn it up.
Go over to patreon.com/truecrimecreepers. You can sign up. We got bonus content over there. Lots of good stuff. And just thank you so much for listening. We love you so much. Thank you so much for listening. Go follow us on Instagram at creeperspod.
Yeah,
that would be awesome.
Do it.
Join our Facebook group, the True Crime Creepers discussion group on Facebook. That would be amazing if you would join us over there.
If you're not following us on Instagram, you should do it soon because I'm going to be posting something on our stories. And you're going to want to participate. It's going to inspire our next mini creep. Oh, I know what you're thinking of. I forgot about that.
Well, we'll do it this week.
Yeah, I forgot about that. That's good. Yep.
We got
yeah, you definitely want to follow us.
For you on the gram. Yeah.
Yeah.
And subscribe so you'll know exactly when our next episode drops, when I'll tell Mogab another wild and crazy story.
Bye, peeps and creeps.